You are listening to Marquette University's COVID Convos podcast. In each episode, representatives from Marquette's STEM and humanities communities will bring you insights into the pandemic that you may be missing. Marquette University is located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the traditional lands of Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, and Menominee peoples along the southwest shores of Michigamme, North America's largest system of freshwater lakes, where the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnic rivers meet and the people of Wisconsin's sovereign Anishinaabe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Oneida, and Mohican nations remain present.
Hi there, and welcome to this episode of COVID Conversations. This one is on rereading and reading during the pandemic. My name is Brittany Platic. I am an assistant professor of English at Marquette University. Today, our three speakers are Jerry Canavan, who is an associate professor in the English department here at Marquette, specializing in 20th and 21st century literature. His first book, Octavia E. Butler, appeared in 2016 in the Modern Masters of Science Fiction series at the University of Illinois Press. Angela Sorby, our next speaker, has published four single author books and two edited collections. She has won multiple awards for her poetry, including a Midwest Book Award and the Brittingham Prize. And then finally, Amy Cooper Carey is the head of special collections and university archives in the Rainer Memorial Libraries. In addition to her Master's of Library Science, she holds a Master's in Comparative Literature and Translation and is an eclectic reader with interests in British history and dystopian fiction. So looking forward to getting to talk with you guys today. So I'll just start off by asking Jerry a question. So Jerry, you have said that you were rereading a lot during the pandemic. And so why are you turning to work that you have read before? What are you reading? And what does this have to do with the way that you've understood your attention during the pandemic?
Well, like a lot of people, I've found it pretty hard to concentrate lately. My main research area is apocalyptic science fiction, which weirdly doesn't help much. It feels somehow like all my research projects have come to life to make me suffer. I've taken a lot of pleasure lately in reading comics, which is the thing I've turned to since graduate school as a way to unwind. I've been doing a lot of long-form board games like Gloomhaven, Pandemic Legacy. And weirdly, I've been rereading Kurt Vonnegut, who I've read semi-religiously since I was a teenager and in moments of different sorts of stress ever since. I started doing this when I was thinking one morning about his novel Timequake, which is about this weird global catastrophe in which everybody becomes sick at the same time. Specifically, they get caught in a time loop where they have to relive the last 17 years of their lives over and over again in exactly the same way. And when the loop is over, they're spat back into normal time and don't know how to live. And they're saved when this science fiction writer, Kilgore Trout, goes around and explains to people that they were sick, but now they're well, and there's work to do. And then slowly people get on to the business of rebuilding the world. And when I remembered that line early in the pandemic, it just struck me so hard, I honestly started crying a little bit. It seemed to encompass so much of what we're going through and what we're going to have to go through in the next however many years of economic disruption and maybe depression as we try to rebuild our world. A friend of mine was rereading Vonnegut at the same time, mostly for the same reasons. And we wound up starting a podcast where we read a different novel or short story from Vonnegut each week and kind of talk it out. Vonnegut is a really interesting writer for the moment. He lived through an apocalyptic event that felt to him like the end of his life and then had to find a way to go on living anyway. So much of his work is about being kind and decent in a world with so much suffering that's so much of it needless. And he has a lot of outdated ideas too, unfortunately, and we talk a lot about those. But mostly it's been a nice place to reflect on where we are right now and where we might go. And for me, in terms of why reread, it's been an antidote to inattention. What a lot of people are calling doom scrolling. You know, I find myself waking up each morning, going to sleep each night, just scrolling Reddit and reading the latest kind of terrible news. And it's really nice to have something that isn't about that, isn't about being online, isn't really about gathering new information or having some new experience. It's almost kind of weirdly meditative to kind of inhabit something you've inhabited before and kind of think through it. It's a nice kind of antidote to attention destruction and the sorts of things that are constantly pulling us away. And podcasts, as this podcast kind of attests to, are a really interesting way to build community, too. It's such an intimate form. And talking each week with Aaron and other people in our kind of weird Twitter network has been a really fun way to kind of, you know, have a regular kind of social experience at a time when you can't have regular social experiences.
Amy, did you want to respond to, like, you and Jerry could just talk a little bit about returning to things that are beloved?
Sure. I think that, this is Amy, I think that Jerry makes a really good point about sense making, meditation, that that idea that rereading has allowed us to kind of restructure our coping mechanisms, to revisit how we establish habit, and habits that we maybe have long assumed even before the pandemic. That's one of the things that I have found, a practice of gathering my reading, of making a list and understanding where reading has taken me over time. I've done this for decades. It really kind of helps me to make sense of where I am, both in history and in the context of the work itself. In that way, I think that reading and rereading are very much like meditation. You can refocus ideas. You can think about fragility. Literature that I've been reading about the pandemic in particular has focused on persistence of hope, something like the Passage trilogy, which I found just absolutely compelling, by Justin Cronin, or the Mad Atom trilogy by Margaret Atwood, kind of giving us an idea that there is at least some fragment of hope. Station 11, for example, Emily St. John Mandel, who also comes across as a hopeful author towards the end. You know, I think that that act of rereading is a way of making sense in our world right now.
So to add a question onto that, and any three of you can respond, Amy, you'd mentioned fragility as being somehow something that rereading has allowed you to work through. And Jerry, you said something similar when you'd mentioned that, you know, Kilgore Trout tells people, you know, things are very bad and they will continue to be bad, but we have work to do. And it seems that there might be some kind of relationship between fragility and rereading. And I don't want to call it resilience, because I'm not sure that's the right word, but could you speak to that kind of recognition of vulnerability? And is that something that you've all found to be coming out of this rereading experience?
I definitely think that's part of what has been interesting about the Vonnegut reread for me. Obviously, in his own work, that kind of vulnerability comes out because, you know, he's a young soldier who goes through this kind of horrendous traumatic experience and then in different ways kind of replays it over the course of his whole life. Since it's been such a touchstone for me over the course of my life, there's a kind of way in which, you know, I'm returning to vulnerable spaces as I pick up the books and read them again in this new context. And it's weirdly helpful to kind of make the sort of self-accounting that Amy was just talking about, right, of where I am and where I'm going and where things have happened, kind of by re-encountering these things I've encountered before. I think for a lot of people, you know, different films, different albums, right, all have that kind of character, right, that it can kind of instantaneously bring you back to an earlier spot in your life. And very often that's because it's a vulnerable spot or a spot of fragility or hurt. So in a moment where everybody seems to need, you know, some kind of collective therapy we can't get, I found it helpful.
Yeah, I've also, and one vulnerability that I think we've encountered a lot is actually the strange world of the internet, which is probably the most vulnerable space that human beings have ever lived in terms of the degree of surveillance and also the degree of dependency that we have. And I mention that only because I left this space for 10 minutes because of an internet fail. And it's like a kind of disappearance of the self, you know, and then you reemerge and it doesn't feel very contiguous. Whereas reading, you have physical control over the technologies if you're reading a physical book. And there is that continuity, and the return that you make to the book is also a form of continuity and reassurance.
Two of the things that I have been reading specifically is a recent collection of short stories called The Decameron Project that was in the New York Times a few weeks ago, contemporary fiction around the COVID crisis, and then revisiting The Decameron by Boccaccio and its novellas. And that idea of consistency and continuity is really interesting, because when you read the short stories either in the New York Times, you know, you can read them all in one fell swoop and it feels connected. You know, you feel that there's a structure, there's a time frame. Same thing with Boccaccio. You've got this structure in the middle of what is today certainly a chaotic time, and certainly during the plague, you know, you had just the utmost of chaos. I also think about Year of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks, which reflected kind of that same chaos, but the continuity of one community within that. So that's a real interesting point that Angela just made.
Yeah, for me, I heard a couple years ago somebody make a joke about how future generations would know people in the 20th century were insane because they put an alarm bell in their house that anybody else could make go off at any time they wanted. You know, we don't really use phones anymore, but we all carry a device that can interrupt us at any moment and make us do whatever it wants, right? With news alerts or work from email and all of these kinds of constant interruptions and, you know, almost always bad news, honestly. So the removal to the book or to, you know, concentrate on some other kind of thing really helps with that. It's that kind of meditation or, you know, moment of singularity that we were talking about when we started, but it's so helpful as a response to something that otherwise, you know, my experience in the last couple months has been at any moment, my phone will tell me that something terrible has happened. Right. And so the book is a space where that doesn't happen.
Also, I think that one of the things the internet has trained us to do is expect order and predictability. And so we see randomness and unpredictability only in negative contexts. And as a person who has always been a bit of a fan of randomness and unpredictability, I've found that, and I don't know if I should segue into this particular point at this point, but I will say I've found that I'm a big fan of gathering and scrounging. I'm the person in the alley taking things that people leave out. The store that I do go to is the Dollar Tree, which is the good dollar store, not the Dollar General, the fake one. And they always have books, and it's unbelievable, the weird selection, everything from Wendell Berry and Toni Morrison to, like, you know, Bible verses for, you know, horsewomen. So I get books from really random places, mostly due to them being free. And so I wind up reading stuff. I feel like that's a randomness that's very reassuring. I haven't read the reviews. I can't predict what it's going to be like. No one has told me that they liked it or didn't like it necessarily. And so it's this kind of encounter with the world that isn't pre-reviewed or predictable in the same way that people have become so addicted to predictability. And I will say the last thing that I wound up getting from a little free library was called The Last Cruise by Kate Christensen. And I don't know if anyone has read that, but it is an unbelievable analysis. A cruise ship and its class and globalization conflicts and a klezmer band and the 1967 Israeli war, and I was blown away. But this book never, I don't think it hit its stride in public, and so no one saw it. And I was like, you know, it's good to kind of go out there and you'll find these gems and these duds, and even the duds can be really pleasurable. I ended up reading the autobiography of Steve Jobs's daughter, which was a kind of meandering and winding narrative, but I still got something out of it, and it was okay that it wasn't the greatest book. So I think the idea is to just keep moving through different worlds and not try to control them too fully.
To ask a question off of that point about control, Angela, I know that you have also been writing during the pandemic. And Amy and Jerry, you can speak to this too, but I'm curious, I tend to think of writing as quite a structured, controlled activity, and I know that that isn't necessarily the case. And I was wondering if there is a way that these reading practices have affected what your writing practices are during COVID and what the relationship is between those.
Well, I think that creative writing, and actually a lot of academic writing has a creative component too, is in the first instance, at the first draft, much closer to dreaming than it is to any kind of conscious organizing or thinking. And then later, it becomes a very structured process if you manage to get anything down on paper that you can work with. So I think that there's the random exploration part first, and then there's the going back and organizing part. So I guess that's related to my preferred way of reading, which is this kind of meander. And back when we used to be able to go to libraries, I absolutely loved doing that too, just pulling books out.
Maybe a kind of question that I could ask on top of that, unless Angela, you were going to read some poetry. I can't see your face, so I'm not sure if you're pausing to...
We had talked about it, and I do have a connected to that poem. I'm not going to read, never fear. I'm not going to commence with a long, unwelcome poetry reading, but I do have a relevant poem to that point, if this is a good time to read it.
I think so. Go for
it. Okay. So about randomness and scrounging. This poem is called The Find, April 2020. Yes, the dollhouse I scrounged from the alley this morning is ruin porn. Its roof caved in, its window panes blown. And yes, I scraped both knees bloody hauling it up the stairs. I'm 55. My skin's thin. I can't absorb more virus news, which is why glue gun, craft paint. My teenager rolls her eyes. Jesus, Mom, you'll never finish that thing. I'm sure she's right. But once I was sure, I'd be married forever. And then came the bulldozer. So maybe never is transient. Like Chaucer's shore soot, like rain falling clean through an open roof. This dollhouse was free, the flyest of prices. Its rooms are large with freedom. The end. So, yeah, that's a poem about maybe about scrounging, obviously, and also about the creative process, and maybe also about a kind of reading where you find something and you decide that you're just going to plunge into whatever it has to offer.
One of the things I really like about that poem and about what you've been saying about writing is just how, I mean, I don't want to say promiscuous, but how promiscuous like coronavirus is in terms of how it attaches to every other thing in our lives. We don't have a prefabricated kind of way of understanding it, of processing it, of knowing when it begins or ends. And so it just kind of like seeps into everything. I know when I try to write now, everything seems to need some kind of like encounter with coronavirus, even if I agreed to do it 2 years ago. And it seems, you know, nothing on the surface connects with it. It's just like, well, coronavirus is here now. And so This project is happening in the context of coronavirus. And there is a way in which part of our kind of collective grief over what's happened and our collective processing of it is about like smushing it into everything else in our lives. And that poem does that in an amazing way.
There's also that concept of fragility that we were talking about, you know, and that idea that we have by reconstructing something that we have found, something that we have scrounged, something that we have listed from our past, something that we are familiar with, by taking it and reframing it in the context of what we're going through right now, it helps us understand where we are. One of the things about that idea of collating, you know, bringing things back together for me, that poem really speaks to that. It's a wonderful, physical, tangible, visible way to recognize a lot of what our conversation has been about, just in a physical sense.
I actually have a question that jumps off of the end of that poem, which thank you for reading that, Angela. It was beautiful. And I'm really struck especially by the final line about, and I'm going to misquote because my memory's shot because COVID, but about the rooms in the house being full of freedom, or there being freedom in this room. And I was wondering if one of the ways that reading and literature, and especially anything that is considered sort of quote unquote pop, is dismissed by people is they say it's merely an escape. It's only escapism. And I was wondering, what's the difference between, because I think there is one, freedom and escape.
The quote was, its rooms are large with freedom. And this was partly a result of the fact that they're actually really small. And I was thinking about how you can be free still in your house. And we are, having lived in China, I can I don't know how to say that word, but I can for sure say that we remain relatively free. But speaking of fragility, this is not a sure thing. And so freedom is a political thing. And it's been appropriated at the moment by some morons. I'm sorry, I don't want to go there, but it's been appropriated to mean things that could be dangerously close to dissociating it from the fact that humans want dignity and a degree of autonomy, and that there are different ways to find this by just controlling your consciousness and understanding what your options are and how many we still have in this country as we sit home. And also maybe that popular culture of domestic space is a valuable thing. There's this concept of doll shaming, where the pop culture that's associated with men is often lifted up, and the pop culture associated with women and girls, traditional girls like dolls and dollhouses, is kind of stupid and couldn't possibly mean anything. But of course, it's like a miniature world, just like other kinds of world building. And through world building, we gain freedom and autonomy in our minds.
When we had just kind of been tossing around ideas of this, we've talked about reading as a way to help us do something rather than just reacting. And it seems to me that that poem speaks directly to that, not just in constructing a world as we find ourselves going back to in our reading and of poetry or fiction, but constructing the space that we are actually occupying right now and reconstructing something that is both physical and representative of that space. The image of reconstructing a dollhouse with blown windows and a caved-in roof is remarkable, because I think all of us certainly feel to a certain extent that our, even if we're living in a house that's fully functional right now, our roof is caved in, our windows are blown, and we do not have anything except craft glue and paint to reconstruct what we're doing. How do we do that? Reading is one act of doing that. Taking the glue gun and fixing a dollhouse is another way of doing that. What physical things have we done to make order out of our world?
Whenever I'm confronted with a version of this question about escape, I always think of Tolkien, especially after I came to Marquette and started doing a lot with Tolkien because of the library and the class I teach. And he, you know, in his famous essay on Fairy Story, he says, there's nothing wrong with escape. Like, a jailed man should dream of escape. Like, that's a perfectly natural thing. So I'm always, you know, a little bit inclined to defend escape. But he also talks about recovery and consolation, right? That these types of stories that are misunderstood as trivial help us to see the world in terms that we always should have seen them in, right? And recover a kind of sense of the world as having an order that the adult world or the kind of realist world kind of denies, and then to kind of push us in the direction of consolation and kind of a way of understanding the world as having, you know, a good order, a kind of good logic to itself, right? A logic of joy instead of sorrow. And so all of those things, I mean, that's so much of what science fiction and fantasy, which are the objects I study, are about. And so it's, always seems to me that there's more going on with somebody who, you know, picks up that kind of work than simply trying to run away from the world, right? You know, we've used the word meditation and different variations on it, but there's something about that attempt to make sense of reality that sometimes requires getting away from reality for a bit.
And it's creative. We had talked about that the attentiveness, the awareness is something different from escape that we think of as putting our heads in the sand, but it's a creative process that we return to, obviously.
I'm utterly astonished by the idea that reading could be the equivalent of putting one's head in the sand, because we know that the one thing that people need right now to think through where we are is context. And that doesn't mean everyone needs the same context, because they couldn't have the same context because we all live in different consciousnesses that take in different things. But we all need expansive consciousnesses that have encountered many things and not just polemical ideas. And the so-called escapist fictions and poetries and science fiction, the good stuff, is not going to be about right and wrong in a clear way. It's going to ask us to put our heads into ambiguous situations, you know, which is kind of an antidote. And I am not against the internet, but it is an antidote to the decontextualized and dehumanizing discourses that can happen when people don't have the depth of context that long texts in particular can provide, that practice of really getting to know a voice, I think is really helpful and political in an indirect but incredibly important way.
I'm just struck by your use of the word ambiguous, Angela, because it reminds me very strongly of one of my favorite sci-fi novels, Lacaille Le Guin's The Dispossessed, whose subtitle is An Ambiguous Utopia. And of course, utopia not here meaning a world where everything's perfect, because that's not a thing, but just a different place, that a no place that lets you recontextualize the way that you understand the place that you are in right now. Maybe to sort of round off this podcast, thinking of the no place that is full of everything that is reading and rereading, I was wondering, and, you know, if you don't want to do this, if it's too schmaltzy, just say no. But if you could each recommend maybe one thing to our listeners, one piece of media, one poem, one novel that you think would be, you know, might help them or be interesting to them, what would you say?
Just one? This is always so terrible.
That was my thought exactly, just one. I have found myself going back to that New York Times magazine. I keep thumbing through it and rereading the stories with the Cameron Project. It's a full issue of the New York Times magazine. And I think what's so compelling about it is that all of the authors are taking different ways into the pandemic. They are taking it. Some of them are intensely personal and very small focus. And others, like Margaret Atwood, wrote a new piece of fiction for it. And hers is just wild. You know, you don't really know what to do with it until you kind of put it in the context of the other stories. So I guess that's one thing I'm returning to, but I could recommend six more.
It is really hard to narrow down to one. My go-to answer to this has been Octavia Butler's Parables books, because they're about an America in the 2020s that seems to be kind of falling apart, where all of the crises that have gone on for so long have, you know, kind of all come to a head at once. And then about not just surviving that, but kind of thriving in it, finding new ways to live and new ways to make sense of the world that can kind of sustain like human life in that context. So it's hard for me not to recommend her work, even though it can be a bit grim. And I don't know that it necessarily ever quite gets to that kind of utopian place of providing an answer, but they're both really kind of generative books, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talent. So that would probably be my one answer if I had to say just one.
Okay, I'm going to cheat slightly, and they're all fiction, even though I was claiming all to those going to talk about poetry. So something really, you want to keep going for a long, long, long time, then the very, very best book is Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman, which is going to explain what's bad about polemicism and totalitarianism left and right in the context of the mid-20th century in an incredibly compelling and page-turning, once you get past the siege of Stalingrad, narrative, Russian narrative. And if you don't want to go there, I would actually say a sort of almost like little world built unto itself that I found so delightful was something I read early in the pandemic, Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell, which is, it sounds really depressing because it's about the Spanish Civil War, but it's like a little world, and it's also full of humanity, and it's full of ideas, and it's full of utopias, and it's full of the flaws that utopian thinking bring. And I was just completely drawn in by that, and it's really shaded everything that I've understood about this pandemic as I watched people start to join their camps. So I recommend that. And it is escapist. It really is. I promise, because it's so beautiful. I don't know if anybody's read it, but it's beautifully written, and he's funny.
Well, thank you, all three of you. Is Amy, Jerry, Angela, thank you all so much for being here and for having this conversation. And thank you, listeners, for joining in. And I do hope that reading sustains you or interacting with media in other ways during this pandemic. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of COVID Convos. You can learn more about this podcast and the research being done at Marquette University by visiting the Research and Innovation website at marquette.edu. You can reach the podcast via email at covidconvos@marquette.edu. Music for this episode is Phase 2 by Xylo Zyko.